Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Writer's Block with Jim Christina and Bobby Bell, right here on LA Talk Radio.
It is 8 o'clock Thursday night. This is LA Talk Radio, and you're listening to The Writer's Block. I am Jim Christina. I'm in the studio tonight with my frequently, what do you want to say, Russ?
Obnoxious
co-host, Russ Avison, because Bobby, of course, is at our Out West concert series tonight. And we have, as a guest, I'm not even going to tell you yet. Everybody relax. You know what? I have my car has that Bluetooth capability. That's you, Russ.
It is something. Yeah. That was interesting.
Yeah, well, your phone is going. Your phone is replaying what we're talking about.
The cabinet studio.
Interesting. Yay.
Anyway, my car has Bluetooth.
Yes.
And I'm sitting here, and I.
That's what we were listening to. It was piping it up from your car.
Oh, it might be. Yeah. I. My car won't let me dial home. I say home, and it goes, it's not there. I don't know what you're talking about. So I say, call house. Oh, would you like to call house at home?
The scary thing is if house answers.
That's right. Well, house does answer, but it's my bookie. It's my bookie, Jerry, who happens to be married to me. What do you got going, Russ?
A terrible headache. This show will get rid of it tonight.
Well,
I'm pumped up for this because I read a book that I'm going to let you do all the introductions. But I read a book and I'm pretty excited about asking a lot of questions because it was so outside the box of anything I've ever read. So I'm very excited.
I have sitting next to me tonight a gentleman who is. I'm going to give a real short bio because I want to get into this. He actually does have a college education. He's from Indiana. He's written a series of wonderful novels and stories about the Merkaba rider, who happens to be a Hasidic gunfighter. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. You've recently won the Stoker Award. You live in L.A. with your wife, kids, and cats. And we'd like to welcome you now, Mr. Ed Erlach, to the Writer's Block.
Welcome.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you, Russ.
You're welcome. Welcome.
I haven't won the Stoker yet.
Well, okay, but you're up for it.
It'd be nice. Okay. Well, it'd be nice.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure it would be. Russ has just been mentioning that he's read Merkaba, the story book. And I've been reading one called Puff Tea, which is a very long book, but very interesting and very authentic to the period. But I want to get into... To start off,
I have the first question. What happened to your brain as a child that caused you to go in this direction? Because this is the most bizarre stuff I've ever read.
Well, it was a melange of growing up, growing up on comic books and WGN classic movies and Samurai Sunday Kung Fu movies and the whole deal. I don't think I was dropped or anything. At least my mom hasn't told me if I was, but...
Medication involved in this?
No, no medication at all. No.
Well, I learned that your mother never tells you if they drop you.
Yeah.
They just say, I don't know what happened to him.
So if she's listening, she's the one to ask. I mean,
did you tell her you're going to be on the radio tonight?
Yeah, I did.
Oh, so cool.
Maybe she's listening.
Well, here's what, just because I'm sure there's some people who haven't read any of your work. And what I got out of this is you take traditional cowboy western type novel and add in either supernatural or science fiction or, I mean, there's a lot of different parts of this. And you come out with a story that just, as I read through it, I kept, now what can happen next? Now what can happen? And it just got more weird and more weird, but in a good way.
Yeah.
I mean, it held my attention from, I think it probably took me a chapter just to get into it because it was a little different. And once I got into it, I couldn't stop.
Cool.
It was very good. I read the whole book in about 3 days.
Good.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
So first of all, where does
Buff
all this...
Buff Tea took
this,
longer, I guess.
Yeah. A longer book.
Well, I'm sure Buff Tea did.
So where did all this come from? I mean, how did you come up with this concept of a Hasidic gunfighter?
Maybe it's I've been living in, I live in kind of a Hasidic neighborhood, and I saw, you know, Hasidic guys walking around every Sabbath, you know, on the way to temple and everything, and I thought of how much I really wanted to wear one of those hats because they're so awesome, you know, seriously. And no, honestly, my wife had a book on angelology or something that she picked up somewhere in a bargain bin at B&N or something. So I was flipping through it, and I found the term Merkaba rider, and it just conjured up this image. Like, it said basically that it was like a Jewish ecstatic who kind of explores the upper reaches of heaven and everything, like through meditation and astral travel and stuff. And I got this image of a guy. It talks about in the Bible that I think it was Elijah went up to heaven in like a fiery chariot or something like that. And so I got this image of like a cowboy on a flaming horse, basically, like, rearing up and everything, and just kind of went from there. I was a big fan of Robert E. Howard, the Texas writer that did he created Conan the Barbarian, but he also did this character called Solomon Kane that was like a Puritan that would go around like you know, fighting evil and stuff like that, sword fighting and stuff like that. And so I kind of was thinking of a Jewish Solomon Kane, basically. And then I was a huge fan of Kung Fu with David Carradine.
Right.
And that's a fish out of water story of a guy that just goes into bars and gets, you know, his ass kicked for, like, asking for tea instead of beer or something.
Right.
You know? And I just like the idea of that culture clash. And, you know, I'm a big fan of Westerns. And I'd been trying to write straight Westerns for, like, years and not having a lot of... it was hard kind of just getting an audience for it and stuff. But I found that when I... Yeah, injected the weird stuff into it. I mean, I found an audience for it, which was surprising to me, too, because I was like, am I the only one that's going to like this? Because at that point, I was just kind of writing for myself.
For sure.
And I guess, you know, more people liked what I liked than I thought, you know.
It certainly is a diverse universe you have out there, Mr. Erlach.
Yeah, yeah. And Lovecraft, too. I mean, I don't know if you guys are familiar with H.P. Lovecraft.
H.P. Lovecraft, yes.
Yeah, there's a big Lovecraft influence. And I'm looking up the Kabbalistic stuff for, you know, Jewish folklore and everything. They had this tradition existing already of, like, creatures and entities existing before creation and stuff that you're not supposed to study and that, like, you know, God suppressed and everything. And
right.
So it fit right in with the Lovecraft stuff, which is kind of what he writes about anyway. So it just kind of... I don't know, it was like a perfect storm. It all just kind of meshed, so.
I've recently been reading a series of books by Lee Child's Jack Reacher series. I don't know if you're familiar.
Uh-huh.
And the writer kind of reminded me a little bit of the Jack Reacher character, only from the standpoint that he's out there on his own, and he's traveling around, and he doesn't lose.
Yeah.
You know, and so, you know, that kind of was going in the back of my head, except that there was some times when he would back down.
Uh-huh.
Where Reacher never backs down, but
but
he always came back around. But I mean, and you injected some. I mean, Doc Holliday is in there.
Yeah,
and
I like to move, like, put historical like characters and weave them in there. And Doc Holliday is something that everybody knows, you know. And,
sure.
And he's awesome. And then mysterious Dave Mather shows up, I think, in the same story. That's the one where he loses his gun on a train.
And right. It gets stolen from him, and he wants to go back and get it.
Yeah, he carries a gun. I should mention it's a volcanic pistol, and it's this lever-action old clunky pistol, but it's like it's gilded in like gold and silver, and it has like a jeweled Sephiroth, which is like this kind of spiritual Kabbalistic symbol on the... It's got all these talismans and things on it
that
allow him to use it in the astral plane and everything.
Mm-hmm.
But to, you know, a guy robbing a train, it's a, you know, gold and silver pistol with the diamonds all over it. So the guy stole it. And so, that was one of the stories in Mensch with
Your character in Buff T also carries a Vulcan.
He does carry a Vulcanic. And that was, I think that was, I was mentioning to Jim earlier that Buff T is like the third book that was published, but the first I ever wrote. And that was where I discovered the Vulcanic. And
Tell me about the, because I'm not a gun.
Vulcanic was a company that was back in the 1840s, 1850s. And they were the first ones to come up with the lever actions. The Vulcanic pistol was the same thing as the Vulcanic rifle. It was a lever action, only it had a pistol grip.
Yeah.
Oh.
And it was, I shot, I think, what, 40 caliber rimfire?
Yeah. You push them through the bottom of the lever, just like a Winchester rifle, but it was a pistol.
Wow.
So it was really kind of awkward.
Yeah, it was kind of awkward, and they were ugly.
Yeah.
I mean, look
and I would guess heavy.
Yeah,
oh,
it's
yeah.
very kind of... I picked up one of those, like, replicas of it. And actually, a buddy of mine dressed it up like the pistol from the writer, so I could put it at the table, you know, when I'm at a con.
Oh, that's
stuff.
Cool.
And yeah, you try to hold that thing, and you definitely can't really spin it on your finger or anything.
Do you have to use two hands to operate it? I mean... With the lever action?
Well, not to shoot it, but to cock it, you do.
Yeah, you kind of have to. And
every shot has to be.
It's just like two hands on a Winchester. It's the same thing.
That's nuts. And especially because some of the sequences in the book, things are happening really fast.
Yeah. So I kind of take a little liberty because I kind of picture it as like. Like, if you ever see the Rifleman, you know, Chuck Connors, or Schwarzenegger in Terminator 2, you know, he uses a wind, like a, what is it, a shotgun, though, in Terminator?
Right.
Yeah, he kind of flips it over and cocks it and shoots it, so, but it's a little fancy, a little movie. Sorry, Jim.
That's okay. Movies are movies are movies are movies. You tend to mix in science fiction, mysticism, paranormal.
Yeah.
Along with, and all your stories. And all your stories aren't Westerns.
No. I've kind of started branching out.
Yeah. Why don't you give us a little about those?
Well, let's see. I got my first non-Western novel is coming out next month. That's Andersonville. It's still, like, on the border because that's a Civil War. It takes place during the Civil War. Mary Todd Lincoln, you know, who was all into spiritualism and everything, has this advisor, and she sees this crazy vision of, like, the White House drenched in blood and all this, and it kind of stemming from Camp Sumter, Georgia, which was, like, Andersonville prison, the big Confederate prison down there. It was, like, awful. There were, like, 30,000 guys in there, and they're half-starved, and, there were no facilities and no shelter even. They were in a big pen, and disease was real rampant and all this, and they were starving, but... Basically, the concept of that is that it's kind of a church of pain, and this guy inside the prison is using it as this, like, to enact this big occult ritual to swing the tide of the Civil War for the South. But the thing is, the South doesn't want him to do this, you know?
Sure.
And, because the South is Protestant and Christian, they don't want any part of this. And then Mary Todd Lincoln, though, in the meantime, sends this Union agent down to infiltrate the prison and figure out what's going on. And this guy has, like, an occult background. He's actually Louisiana Creole, and he's from this kind of background of Dahomey West African magic and this big, like, long bloodline and everything. He began as a Southern officer they had a thing called the Louisiana Home Guard, which was like native African Creole kind of like what's the word I'm looking for, like hoity-toity kind of
Upper echelon, upper crust.
Yeah. The rich
snooty.
Yeah. The rich African American like Creoles down there kind of formed up a unit to defend New Orleans against the Admiral Farragut and stuff, the Union. So this guy started out as that, but then he winds up, through a long series of events, he winds up on the Union side, basically, questioning his original whatever. And he becomes a black dispatch agent, which was Union. The Union used to use ex-slaves and African-Americans as the perfect spies in the Civil War and everything because the Southerners kind of, like, overlooked them and stuff, you know?
Sure.
So he infiltrates this prison and finds a Southern agent already in place trying to, do the same thing he's doing. So they have to team up and kind of, like, battle this supernatural evil in the middle of Andersonville.
Wow.
Yeah, so that's coming out from Random House, actually. Their Hydra imprint next month in August. And
you excited?
Yeah. It was a nice paycheck for one, like, which I'm not used to. And they're getting behind it. It got a starred review on Publishers Weekly, which means they liked it and everything. So it's pretty cool. I'm excited about that. And
gives you a chance to stay home and wrangle the kids.
Yeah, wonderful. Like, I hadn't had that chance before.
How long did it take you to write that one?
That one took me about 4 months. I was on a deadline for that one. Yeah, they actually came to me with the bare bones concept. They came to me, which was crazy.
Because really?
I've been trying to, like, break into that kind of stuff forever. And they were fans of Macabre Rider, basically. And they wanted somebody that could, like, do up this historical supernatural concept. And the basic concept was just, like, that somebody's doing something bad in Andersonville Prison. And I was like, well, I started bouncing ideas off of them. And they liked it, and I liked their ideas back. And,
sure.
And just expanded and did it in, like, 4 months.
Wow. Now, so an idea, because I'm not in the writing world. So an idea like that, who originally,
it was
had the seed of this concept.
It was an editor at Del Rey called, his name was Frank Parisi, and his partner Chris Mori, and they're both at Lucasfilm now. And actually, that's how I got it, was because I had a couple of short ties at Lucasfilm, because I did a couple short stories for Star Wars and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And Pablo Hidalgo was who's now like the the main, like one of the main story guys at Lucasfilm, who kind of keeps all the continuity going and everything in the expanded stuff, liked my writing and suggested me to this guy and said, here, read this, and gave him a cover writer. And yeah, they came to me with it. So that was pretty cool.
That's pretty amazing.
It was. It was amazing to me. I thought they were kidding when they emailed me.
So. You sure I'm the one you want to talk to?
Yeah, yeah.
Here, we want you to do this, and we want to give you a lot of money to do it.
Yeah, exactly. It was pretty amazing.
So from beginning to actually completion was 4 months?
About 4 months, yeah.
Wow.
I mean, but then, you know, with a big publisher like that, there's still a lot of, like, it goes through a lot of edits and you know, the promotional stuff and everything. So it's been about a year and a half now, I think, that I've been since I've written it. So
now, being that it was kind of the idea kind of formulated with Lucasfilm, or the guys that are
with
there Delray, now,
yeah.
Does that mean that there might be film for this later on?
That'd be nice. I mean, I don't know if I'd be attached to it or anything, but it'd be pretty nice. Yeah, they have their own. A lot of the big publishing houses are getting their own developing, you know, departments now that are specifically for film. So, like, in the idea of developing IPs, because a lot of the films now are based on stuff that's already been out.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's kind of hard for... I originally came out here to do screenwriting, and I wrote, like, 12 screenplays, and nobody read them. So it was like, I'm kind of going the long way around the barn now, but, you know. Yeah, they tend to, like... They're more interested in developed IPs, stuff that's already got an audience, than in, like, original scripts and stuff. At least that's what I've found.
Well, they're also interested in remaking old stuff.
Yeah, and remaking old stuff, exactly.
A lot.
Yes. Yeah. Well, too much, actually. Well, my opinion.
Yeah, I think you're right, you know, but at least give it 40 years or something.
Yeah, I mean, you know, time, let you know? Somebody die before you remake it.
Yeah. I think we've rebooted Spider-Man like 3 times now.
I know, huh? Come on. And they keep changing Supermans. I'm so confused. and Batmans, I might add.
And Batmans, yeah.
That's right. That's right. Well, at least Spider-Man got 3 movies before they changed him.
Yeah.
So, but when you start a project like the book that I read, do you have an idea where you're going from beginning to end before you start writing, or do you just kind of have a concept, go into it, and kind of lead you along?
With Merkaba Writer, because those books are kind of, I should mention that they're kind of set up like almost like collections of this guy's adventures, you know,
right.
That's not like a traditional novel. It's more like 4 long chapters, I guess, kind of, but like 4 novellas or something.
Mm-hmm.
That was because I used to read, I think I mentioned the old Robert E. Howard stuff, and he used to, you know, Penguin and Ace used to put out these paperbacks in the 70s with, like,
oh my God, I
with
do remember
those
that.
Awesome Frazetta covers, yeah. And stuff. And they just collect the stories like that. And I wanted it to kind of be like that, you know, like the continuing adventures of this character and everything, but yet also give it like an arc. You know, I couldn't keep a long arc out of it. So it is like a novel. But yeah, I kind of start out with Merkaba Writer. I think of something like a bizarre image, and then I like basically try to come up with a reason for it. You know? Like I think for the one we were talking about in the room over there, like I thought of a guy catching a cannonball. I think
right.
for that one, and I was like, all right, I want to write a story where a guy catches a cannonball, and then like, but I mean, you know, I also have like a long over like arc that I want to get through. So I mean,
right.
I'm not just pulling it out of my ear.
But. Yeah, but then you just you went the further distance on the cannonball, and then you started strapping people in front
of
the cannons.
Yeah, and that
actually, they were doing that first. That's how it was. They were, in fact, they thought it was thunder.
Yeah,
and they'd hear the boom, and then they felt the rain, yeah. And it was at night, and all of a sudden they realized the rain was like blood and body parts.
And body parts. Yeah,
yeah. And so then they realized they were blowing these guys up. But then he had the one guy who the young kid. I guess it was that wanted to. He got out there and he didn't even realize he had this power.
Yeah.
And a cannonball was coming, and he puts his arms out and he saw everything in slow motion. And he was able to catch a cannonball.
Yeah, and that was the Jewish folklore just was so rich. I mean, I can't remember the exact name of the phenomenon, but it's basically the story of Samson. You know that he took an oath that he couldn't cut his hair and he
right.
couldn't.
Right. In fact, his parents had told him that.
His parents told him that,
that's
and
right.
he didn't really. You know, he was like whatever. He was like a circus strongman kind of guy.
Well, he let he let his woman talk him into.
Well, his mother in this case.
Yeah.
And that was where that came from. Yeah, the folklore like added so much. I mean, once I got into that, I was just finding ideas left and right and stuff because it hadn't really been tapped really either.
Mm.
I mean, you know, when you watch like supernatural stuff, there's a lot of. Christian and Catholic stuff with angels and, you know, crucifixes driving off vampires. But the Jewish stuff is awesome. I mean, if you read it, they got some really great stuff.
Do you have any Jewish background yourself?
No, none at all. I get at cons a lot, at conventions, people come up and, like, this one lady came up to me, I remember, and was like, the mensch with no name. She was like, you don't look M-O-T. And I had to go, I was like, I just grinned at her and I had to go home and look it up because I didn't even know what it meant.
That is so funny.
So did you run this, any of those books past your neighbors?
No, I haven't. I don't know if they're, I mean, but I do get emails from like guys that give it to their rabbis. And I had one guy tell me that it should be in like, you know, Talmudic studies, schools and stuff.
Rabbinical journal.
Yeah. Or like the Jewish kids should read it and stuff. So, I mean, that's pretty cool. I mean, it's nice that I like, I'm trying to do it justice too. I'm not just trying to like, you know, cherry pick stuff. So
no. I mean, he held his theories through, I mean, through the book, his beliefs he carried through, you know, and all the time when there was the dead people and stuff, and he wasn't allowed to touch the deceased. And,
yeah. Because,
oh, tell me about his animal.
The
onager?
Onager, yeah. It's a West African kind of donkey, basically. It's like a
Is that a real animal?
It is. I looked it up, yeah. Oh. I wanted him to have like a cool kind of signature like animal, kind of like silver, but the rider, he's like the Indians call him the rider who walks because he doesn't walk on animals. And I kind of got that from Kung Fu because he had this thing.
He never rode anything.
He always said, I don't want to burden the horse. Is what David Carradine always said. But,
yeah. But I liked the concept in the book. When he said that, I thought that was way cool. And I'm a big animal activist. So
yeah.
I like the idea.
And there's more to that. Like, if you read the further books, I mean, there's a lot more to that animal than just, it's not just a regular animal. You know. But.
Well, I really, because there was something really interesting. Every time something was happening to all the horses, the onager was just
the animal,
okay.
Totally
he was okay.
Calm, yeah.
And he survived a lot.
Yeah. Yeah, I think he loses a bit of his ear in one book or something. Right. But
I don't know. I keep getting accused of shooting horses.
Do you do that a lot?
Oh, yeah. I lose a lot of horses. But then in the Old West, in real life, horses got shot.
My mom wouldn't read. Like, she took me to town for Buff Tea, the part where the horse gets gored by the buffalo and gets disemboweled. And she was like, oh, my God, I can't believe you did that and everything. And I'm like,
well,
I didn't really do it. I mean, it happened, you know?
It's a story.
Yeah. My sister-in-law calls me and says, why do you kill off everything that I like?
Yeah.
you kill off everyone that I like, including the horses.
Well, my mom, I tried to watch Dances with Wolves with her. Mm-hmm. And, you know, which animal dies first? I think the wolf or something?
The wolf? No.
No, the horse.
The horse does.
The horse dies, and my mom was like, oh, my God, I can't believe they did that and everything. And then,
and
like,
then the wolf.
Then the wolf is on the ridge, and she turns to me and goes, are they going to kill that wolf? And I was just kind of looked at her. She was like, turn this off. So she never finished Dancing with Wolves.
And that was almost the end of the movie.
Yeah, I know.
Oh, man. Well, you talk about the horses, and you said in the book that you read, Jim, that the horse gets gored.
Yeah, it gets gored by buffalo.
Yeah.
That's nothing compared to what happens to the horses in this other book. I will say it's pretty bloody.
It is pretty violent. Yeah,
it is, and I had to every once in a while just okay, it's just a story, yeah. You know. But yeah, it was a lot of horses.
Well, a lot of people too. To be fair,
yeah,
a lot of people get it too. I'm kind of equal opportunity. And buildings. And
oh, yeah, that one town, Tank, what's it called? Varuga Tanks.
Yeah.
Destroyed. I mean, it's...
Which I got kind of that from Three Godfathers with John Wayne.
Remember
the guy blasted the tanks and
then
there was no water anymore?
Right.
And it was like a big deal, you know? And this was like a little town that built up around this watering hole. And when they blow it up, you know, it's like...
By the way, tell me, with the weapons that they were using, those cannons, did they really have the accuracy that was in the book? I mean, because they were pretty right on.
Probably not, but you got to remember, too, that cannon wasn't entirely just a regular cannon, too.
Sure.
I mean, it was like the story behind that one was that, and I got this a little bit from Milton, because in John Milton, Paradise Lost, there's a part where the devil creates, like, infernal machines to fight the angels in this big war they're having. And so this was, like, left over from that was this cannon that was actually a demon that they kind of, like, constructed into a cannon, and it's harnessed in there and stuff. And so, yeah, it's a little bit more accurate than, like, a regular Napoleon.
It was very accurate.
Yeah. They were doing pretty well with it.
Let's get into a little character development, if you would.
Sure.
The characters that you got in Buff Tea, the main... Buffalo runners, as you call them. Well, they probably call themselves. Rome Welty and what is it? Warbag Tyler was great.
Ah, good. Thanks.
Yeah, Warbag Tyler is like really, he's this crotchety, this dude.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, he's like the leader of this merry band of men.
He's kind of like a little bit like Call, I think.
Lonesome that's what, kind of what I got too.
Yeah.
A little dirtier.
Yeah, a little bit worse than Call. Yeah. I pictured him as a, when I came up with him, he was kind of like an Ahab in the West, is what I was thinking.
Yeah, and you have a character that I absolutely just loved. Now, the protagonist in this book, it's all first person, and he never, you never learn this guy's name, but this guy from Louisiana, his name is Fuke?
Yeah,
Latouche.
Yeah,
calls his kid Juniper and just pisses him off.
And that's his name through the whole book.
That's his name through the whole book, Juniper. And you never do learn his real name.
Yeah,
calls him Juniper.
Yeah,
but these characters are so wonderful. This Fuke Latouche, I just loved.
From West Baton Rouge. From West Baton Rouge. If he always made the distinction.
Yes, he would not be with the hoity-toities on the other side.
East Baton Rouge, he didn't want to have anything to do with. And the kid was like, I've never been to Baton Rouge, so no idea.
But, I mean, developing these characters had to have been a real treat for you.
Yeah, you feel like you know them after a while and stuff, and so it's kind of sad when you come to the end.
Yeah.
And you know, you got to say goodbye to them and stuff. But
yeah, I did that with a couple, but I found that the more you learn and the more you develop the character, the more they write their own story.
Yeah, they take off on their own.
They do. I mean, you're thinking, I'm not going there. The character's telling you, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, you are.
I never stick to an outline. No. I try it and forget it. It just goes all over the place.
I know where the chapter's going to start. I know how it's going to end.
Yeah.
And how it gets there.
Yeah, anybody's guess.
It's anybody's guess. Somebody's going to die.
When you develop characters, are they many times a compilation of people that you know or have read about, or do you just start from scratch?
There's definitely something of that. Yeah, there's definitely like people. I have people in mind with like for mannerisms or the way somebody looks, maybe an actor or something. But I don't know. I really believe almost like, and this is going to be weird, I guess, but I feel like they come, like maybe they existed somewhere, you know, and I'm just kind of tapping into this or something, or maybe it's
cosmic reality.
Yeah, or maybe it's the other way around, that like once I'm thinking of it, they're coming to, you know, life somewhere. I don't know, but
they're appearing back in the 1870s
somewhere else.
Thinking about it,
somewhere, you know, right. I don't know, but that's what I feel like, the life of their own thing, you know, because they behave on their own sometimes.
Do you think there's a mystical side to the writing? I mean, seriously,
I definitely think there is. Yeah, because if you even read, have you ever read Stephen King's On Writing? He has this great book on writing called On Writing, and he says that he has this cool thing where he says that writing is telepathy. Like, I wrote this, you know, whatever, on a typewriter in Maine years ago, and you're reading it right now, and I'm communicating you from the past, you know?
Ah, so it's interesting concept. It's an
interesting way of looking at it.
Yeah, yeah. But, I mean, and Howard used to say this, too. Robert E. Howard used to say, like, that he would feel Conan over his shoulder, kind of, like, dictating his stories to him and stuff.
Hmm.
And I think there's a little bit of that. Because, I mean, I said, right in Buff T, there's characters where, like, I wrote this guy to die in chapter 4, and he's like, I'm not dying now. You know?
I got that. I do the same thing, though. I introduce characters, and 4 pages later, they're dead.
Yeah.
So I get that part. Hey, look, if you want to call in and talk to Ed, our number here is 818-602-4929. That's 818-602-4929. And I think I must probably have to pay the bills at this point. So The Writer's Block is brought to you by Black Dog Publishing and Out West Boutique and Cultural Center, of which Bobby Jean tonight is at the Out West Concert Series, and we give a shout out to Bobby Jean if she happens to be listening, or will hear the podcast tomorrow. And right now we're going to go to a little music and give you all a potty break. we're back, and thanks for joining us. And if you haven't been with us so far, well,
where the heck you been?
We have a caller coming in, so you're on the writer's block.
Hi, it's the Bookie.
Hi, Bookie. How you doing? Bookie.
But that's a whole other
Jerry.
Show.
Oh, hey.
Ed, nice to hear you. Nice to, I guess, meet you, kind of.
Yeah, sort of. Nice to meet you, too.
Jim's wife. I would like to ask you about the editing process and what you go through to turn in. Do you turn in chapters, or how does that work, and who pays them? Because I don't get paid.
She really doesn't.
Who pays for the chapters? Or?
No, who pays the editors?
No. Who pays the editors?
Oh,
no.
Who pays the
No, seriously.
Yeah, yeah.
How does that work? How do you submit chapters? Do you go, like, 10 chapters? Or how does that work, and who has the final say?
Well, like for Random House, they actually, when they came up with the idea for that, they were thinking about releasing it as a series of novellas, so they had it broken up into kind of novellas.
Mm.
And I
oh,
would
okay.
submit the novellas as I finished them and stuff. And early on, the suggestions were kind of light, like, well, maybe do this or maybe change this. I mean, they were kind of happy with what I was doing. But later on in the process, it gets very involved. And I was really impressed with it because I usually work with small presses and stuff, and uh-huh. I maybe get one pass on an edit or something. But with Random House, it was like they'll give me like three or four passes. And then they have a guy whose job is just to look for stuff that words that historically don't exist in the 1860s. And he's like, you might look at these and stuff. And then I had another one who was just, story stuff, and another one that was just spelling. I mean, they had an editor for every aspect. And
wow.
They had a bank of guys working on it, which was really cool. So I'm happy with that because it'll be whipped to shape by the time it comes out.
And she doesn't really get paid.
And I don't really get paid.
No.
But do you ever disagree with what they have to say, and how much is your input?
I think I had to argue once with like one little character detail or something, and it was basically more of a clarification. Like they said something like, "Would this person?" There's a character in the book who is raped, basically, and they were like. One of the guys came to me and was like, is she really raped here? Because, like, it doesn't seem like it was like she was with a guy and then she said no to the guy once and she was raped, you know?
Uh-huh.
And he was kind of like, well, was she really raped? And I was like, well, yeah. I mean,
she said no.
So, like,
was he really looking for, like, a description?
No. Yeah, I don't know if you wanted to see it. No, it was more like, well, wasn't it consensual? And I was like, no. It was once you say no, that's it. But it was like, I was like, I thanked him because I was like, I'm going to use that because, you know, like if there's a guy who says to her, well, was it really rape?
Well, it's like the
so
old.
That wound up in the book, you know, and it became like a contention and everything in the books. So.
Yeah, it's like the old, you know, two no's is still a yes.
Yeah, right. Exactly. But I mean, there wasn't too much. They were very open to anything that I had to say. Yeah. So they trusted me with the material and I trusted them with the editing. So it was nice. Yeah,
well,
it was a good relationship.
Well, that's good because I would really like to know more about that process and the way you get your characters. Like, this is a great interview that these guys are doing tonight.
Yeah, they're good.
Russ, quit whining, by the way, your headache.
It's gone now, by the way.
I bet Bobby
doesn't
mind about
good.
It.
But anyway, I've enjoyed the interview. I think this is a great interview.
Great,
keep on going and have a good night.
We're
thank
not
you,
done yet.
Thank you.
Thank you,
thanks
Bookie.
Thanks for calling in. Thank you.
I'll see you at home.
Bye. Okay, bye.
She's probably going to quit. You won't find her there
until
you start paying.
I wound up having to give her $20 a couple weeks ago just to keep her quiet. Didn't work, though, because she came on the show and started complaining about
She's your editor. That's what she was saying. Okay, I get it. Yeah,
but, you know, she does a really good job.
That's great, because my wife won't read my stuff. So
She'll read it. I give her a chapter at a time, and she goes through it, and she red pencils everything, and then I go back in and make her changes, and then she reads it all again, and she finds more stuff, and I fix that. She's known as a comma queen. And then when we get a proof, then she goes through that, and she makes more changes.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, she's about three, four times she's gone through that book before it ever.
I don't know, Jim, if you really tuned in on what she was asking, but she said to Ed, now, do you ever really have arguments? Do you disagree
well,
with what the editors
we
say?
Do
you? I know, but then he said only once.
Yeah. Ed said only once.
Yes. Yeah.
In my experience with that one. But what about you?
I could say 15 times all the time. During the book. It's because a lot of times it has to do with dialogue.
Yeah.
And dialogue, especially Old West dialogue, had to be written phonetically because otherwise there's...
You don't get the cadence.
Where you don't get the cadence. And as we know, and you know you're a writer... Dialogue is got a rhythm to it,
mm-hmm.
and if you miss that rhythm anywhere in that sentence does not work.
Yeah,
so I mean that's what I'll argue with her about. Not her punctuation or any of that stuff because she's really good at that. Just the dialogue, and if I'm wrong, you can call back.
Well, you should pay her though, Jim. You should make her a hamburger or something at least.
Yeah,
I make the house payment.
Oh, there you go. You got a roof over. I don't do that for my editors, so you're one up on me there.
I did, talking about how the dialogue has a cadence to it, there were, and the way they say certain things, I noticed every once in a while in reading through, I would have to stop and reread something because it was so different than what I was used to hearing. And so I'd have to reread maybe a couple words to say, oh, okay, here's what he said.
Yeah, they like... My favorite guy who does old historical dialogue is Daniel Woodrow. If you ever read...
I did. I think I read one of his things years back.
He did... The movie is Ride with the Devil. I'm trying to remember the name of the book, though. He did this one about bushwhackers in the South right before the Civil War. And it's almost Shakespearean. It's almost like reading Shakespeare. You know, mm-hmm. they talk like way,
Yeah.
Florid and everything, but I mean
well,
it is
like wealthy Southerners.
Yeah, but yeah, because they were planters right. and stuff. But it's nicer. It's a prettier way of talking, I guess. Mm-hmm. I mean,
flowery.
Yeah, yeah. I like the way they.
Well, that's why they used to write too. I mean, their letters. Yeah. Did you read their letters?
They're oh, my way God. Literate and amazing.
Oh, totally
I had to read
literate.
A ton of letters for Andersonville, and there's all these camp, prisoner letters and everything, and they're all like, I mean, these guys are in the middle of like. Horrific conditions, and they're writing stuff that
I actually have some letters from Andersonville prison.
Really?
That my cousin's husband, his great, I believe, Joe, if you're listening, I'm sorry if I'm wrong, but I believe it was Ronnie's great grandfather
mm-hmm.
that was in Andersonville. He died. They sent him to another prison, and he died there.
Mm-hmm.
But his letters home has made it through time. And she sent me copies of these. They weren't very good copies because she took them with her cell phone. Or I don't think her scanner was working or her computer wasn't working or something. But, I mean, the ones that came in clear were absolutely phenomenal.
Yeah.
And they're very short.
Yeah.
One page.
But they're like, I mean, if you think of the way people talk and write things now, they repeat themselves all the time and stuff. They didn't have that back then.
Right.
It was very economical.
Right.
Even, I know it sounds like kind of fancy, but it was very economical at the same time. You know, they said what they had to say and they got out.
Right, right. And it was always your loving husband.
Yeah, yeah, always very personal.
Mm. You know, when a couple of months ago we were having a conversation about the show Deadwood.
Yeah.
And how the language in there is very colorful.
Yeah, but yet they still have that kind of flourish.
Right,
right.
Speak.
They
yeah.
did. But now, in reality, do we know, I mean, was there that much profanity in the everyday language?
I was doing a book about Billy the Kid for a while, and I read a thing about the siege. You know, in mm-hmm. Young Guns, when mm-hmm. they have him in the house, and,
right.
they're shooting
right.
at him in the house, one of them yells out, the siege, can I say that?
You can say anything.
Say anything you want.
He yells out. It's in the primary source that right. he yells out, come and get us, cocksuckers.
Right.
It's right, right there. And that was like, what, 1880 something?
1881.
So. Right.
Yeah, yeah.
But now, where did they get the
but when they wrote about it.
Where does the historical knowledge come from? It's nobody was transcribing those conversations.
No. They weren't, but it was passed on generation.
Yeah, like just a guy, like the old. They'll have like an old guy who tells the story or something like that, and then when they actually wrote about him, like in the newspapers and stuff, they'd omit things or talk around
right.
things. And
they alluded to a lot of stuff, but
yeah.
then they also say that language was just as fierce with women as it was for men.
Yeah, yeah, mm-hmm. like Belle Starr
right.
was a big cruiser
right.
and all that.
Well, and it's like the myth that saloons had. Saloon girls, and they didn't. Saloons were like a boys' club.
Yeah.
Men's
really?
Club. There was no women allowed.
Yeah. Unless they were, not even
no,
serving
they,
drinks.
No, they were not allowed in there.
You had to
all.
Go to a specific kind of bar for that.
Yeah, you had to go to a dance hall
uh-huh.
or a gambling house.
Really?
Or a brothel.
There was
good
no
place to pick up women.
No real Miss Kitty hanging around
no,
on the piano.
No, it was never Miss Kitty in Long Branch Saloon.
Uh-huh.
There was Luke Short.
Yeah. Was he a Miss Kitty?
No.
Was he the equivalent?
But he was in the Long Branch Saloon.
Well, you know, I'm thinking about...
I mean, he dressed nice, but...
I'm thinking now about the film Silverado.
Okay.
And Linda Hunt, who played the bartender.
That wouldn't have happened.
Yeah, probably that not.
But she, as I recall, was she the only woman in there?
Yeah. I don't know if they had saloon girls or not, but I just remember I was thinking, nah, that would never have happened.
But I'm sure there were, like, there's always a, you know, an exception.
Sure.
Like, Belle Starr was an exception. She was like a poker queen.
She was, like, more woman, more man than woman.
Yeah, yeah. Didn't talk about it then.
Calamity Jane used to walk into any saloon in town, and nobody stopped
her.
Yeah,
you couldn't say no.
Well, it's because she shoots you. Right.
Well, she was usually too drunk to try to reason with.
Yeah. Or they didn't even notice that she wasn't a woman coming in, Calamity Jane.
All right, I have the question of the night for you.
Mm-hmm.
It's the question, Russ.
Okay.
You don't get any after this, Russ.
This show is called The Writer's Block.
Uh-huh.
Have you ever had writer's block?
No, I can't say I have. I've got too many ideas than time. I got you know, three kids running around the house, and for me, it's just finding the time to get it down. I've always got something like percolating, I feel like. Have you?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah. Yeah. Not often, but I do get it. But I usually find that it's because I've made a wrong turn someplace.
Yeah, I'll say there's days. See, when I think of writer's block, I'm thinking you don't have an idea. But it's more like there's days when I don't write. Yeah, because I'm stuck on something.
Right.
But it's never because it's frustrating. But it's never because I don't have an idea. It's
right.
Just, yeah, it's like you said, you got lost somewhere. You paint yourself in a corner.
Yeah, something. Margaret Brownlee made an interesting observation when she was on. She said to the question, "Do you ever have writer's block?" She goes, "Yeah, well, yeah, everybody gets it." And so, well, how do you get out of it? And she goes, well, I go back and I take a look at it and I change a character's name.
And that works?
It works for her.
Weird.
Wow.
I give it to my buddy Jeff to read and I'm like, tell me how to fix this.
Yeah.
Do you ever write like maybe several chapters going in a certain direction and then you get there and you go, no, this is totally wrong, and then maybe get rid of all that and go a different direction? Or there are usually minor changes?
With short stories, I do that a lot, but not so much books. Yeah, books, I feel like I have more elbow room. I can kind of find the story a little bit easier. But with a short story, you know, you gotta get in and out, and it's got to be, there's usually a word count. And so I'll do that, start and stop on those a lot.
In fact, that brings up Star Wars.
Yeah.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about that.
Oh, how I did Star Wars stories. All right, I've done two Star Wars short stories, and I'm actually working on getting another one going and everything, and hopefully a book eventually. But that started out with Lucasfilm was running, StarWars.com was running this contest where they'd pop up some alien or some guy that showed up in the background of Star Wars. And there were so many guys wandering around in Star Wars, you know.
Right.
And they're like, make a background for this guy, basically.
Oh.
And it was just, and they opened it up to all the fans, and you just sent in your submission or whatever. It was 500 words or something, and I won for 3 months. And so that's how I met Pablo. He put out Pablo Hidalgo, the story group guy, put out a call for, like, he was the webmaster at the time or whatever, the web content guy. He put out a call for stories for to put online in their hyperspace feature. And I did one about a boxer in the Star Wars universe. It was basically... the Brown Bomber, like the story of the Brown Bomber and Max Schmeling, but in Star Wars. It was like the rebels were using this guy as propaganda in this imperial planet to kind of get all the people up in arms and stuff. It was a boxing match in Star Wars, so it was called Fists of Ion.
That's clever.
So yeah, they liked that, and that came out. And then I did one for the magazine. They have a fan magazine, Star Wars Insider, that's put out by Titan.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did a story for that, and that one I pitched through Frank Parisi, my guy at Del Rey, because as soon as I got the Andersonville job, I was like, you guys do Star Wars too, right? And he's like, yeah. And I'm like, because I've been trying to get more Star Wars work. And you know, you think maybe I could pitch you a story? And he was like, yeah, pitch a story. So I did. And it was like a Lovecraftian kind of Star Wars story with this Jedi that like finds an old ancient artifact and puts it on. And it kind of possesses him and stuff. And they liked that. And so that came out like, but it came out in January. And it came out right before they announced that they were pitching all the old continuity out in favor of new continuity. And I literally missed the cutoff by like 2 months or something. So that kind of sucked. And but now I'm trying to work on getting another one going with the guys at Del Rey. So, yeah. And I said that led to Andersonville. So
There you go.
Yeah.
You never know where it's going to take you.
Yeah, I had no... it was a contest I was just doing for fun. I think I wrote it on my break or something at the job. I was working overnight at a video game company. I was
like, God, what a job.
Yeah, it was. It was a pretty great job. It was just playing video games all night. It was pretty amazing. It was QA, so we were looking for bugs ostensibly, but you're basically playing like basketball all night. So.
Okay, real quick.
Yeah.
You directed an indie western movie.
I did, yeah. Yeah.
Come on, give.
That was called Meaner Than Hell, and I said that was at the end of my screenwriting like trials. I was like, you know, what happened was Kaiser Permanente bought our building where we lived in Panorama City, and we're going to knock it down, turn it into a parking lot, and they gave us all relocation money, and we had enough to kind of get by already. And I asked my wife, hey, can I use this to like try to put a feature together? And I didn't know anything. I didn't realize you're supposed to use other people's money when you do like an indie movie. So like I put this thing together, and it was like 90 minutes long, and it was a script about about a bounty hunter who finds this guy in the desert and kills his gang, and then handcuffs him and says, "I'm taking you back." And but he's kind of unscrupulous, and he wants to find the guy's the money that the guy stole, this outlaw. So he shoots him in the foot and says, "I'm not taking you to, you know, fix that foot until you show me where the money is." And then in the middle of the night, Apaches steal all their horses. So they're stuck in the desert, chained to each other, and this guy's got a rotting foot, and they're trying to make it back to civilization and trying to screw each other over the whole time and everything. I was happy with the story, but if you've never tried to make an independent film all by yourself, it's like writing is like you're typing, and doing a movie like that all on your own is like trying to type with boxing gloves on. Really freaking hard. I mean, I had some guys. I had like a DP lined up that was awesome that I went to film school with and all this, and he kind of like backed out a month before filming to do a movie for The Rock. I'm talking about The Rock again.
Yeah.
For The Rock. I think it was the football movie he did. He was an electrician on that, so I had to shoot it myself.
Where his daughter showed up at his door?
Yeah, that was the one, I think. I can't remember the name of it. But I had to shoot it myself, and I had to... I had a pretty good editor, but it was like I just did everything myself. And it was written for a budget. That's why this horses got stolen, because horses are expensive. So it's out on YouTube, because that was the only person, that was the only way I could get it out to anybody.
It's called Mean as Hell?
Meaner Than Hell.
Meaner than Hell.
I took it from the Johnny Cash thing about, the song, Meaner Than Hell. So.
Well, Ed, we're running out of time. You want to give us your contact information, email address?
Sure. You can look me up on Facebook by my name, Edward Erlach. I also have a blog called Delirium Tremens.
Which, yes, you do.
Was the town that they were going after in Meaner Than Hell. And that's emertalak@wordpress.com. You can find me on there. And if you want to email me, it's emertalak@gmail.com.
Pretty easy.
Yeah, pretty easy.
Yeah, yeah. Well, thanks again, Russ.
Thanks for having me, you guys.
And thanks for coming in.
Thanks for filling
pleasure.
In, Russ.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Hey, this was a fun show. I told you you'd have a good time.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
We didn't pick on you at all.
No, not so much. I expect that'll happen when we get off the air, right?
I expect you're right. Probably right.
Beat up in the parking lot.
Well, he has to
look under your hood before you start your car.
Right.
Russ has to go put a dog down, so he's not going to be hanging around.
Yeah. That's terrible.
But anyway, thanks again for coming in.
Thanks for inviting me, you guys. Oh, I really appreciate it.
Absolutely more than welcome.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody have a great week.
Yeah, everybody.
Next week we're here with, who are we here with next week?
Don't look at me, I don't know.
I told you.
Not me.
Oh.
I won't be here.
I had another brain fart of just giant proportions. Henry Park.
Yeah, you did tell me. Henry's Western Roundup.
Yeah,
right.
Henry's Western Roundup. He did a really wonderful write-up on this show.
Cool.
And so we kind of felt obligated to bring him in.
He's a great guy.
He's a great guy, and he interviewed us together a couple, two, 3 years back.
Yeah, at the Cowboy Festival.
And we're looking forward to seeing Henry, and looking just sad that this hour's over with.
Yeah, it was a great time.
It's been a good time. It's been a real good time. And with that, we're going to go home.
Yeah. Sayonara, everybody.
Sayonara, everybody.
Shalom, partners.